Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call them potato.
The Republican debate food fight we were waiting for finally happened. And Bernie Sanders rose in the polls. We'll explore why. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com and host of the new KCRW podcast, Scheer Intelligence. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and our special guest is Amy Walter, national editor at the Cook Political Report. Welcome to all of you.
Well, I guess the bromance is over because he hit me. I didn't hit him. I hit him after the fact. And so I guess the bromance is over. I mean, there was no reason for him to go that aggressive. But he started talking about New York in a very negative way, and I thought it was inappropriate.
That was Donald Trump declaring the end of his bromance with Senator Ted Cruz after Thursday's debate. Trump and Cruz had two big spats. One was the fight that Trump was mentioning over New York values and whether it's a problem if Donald Trump has them. The other was a controversy Trump has been stirring up about whether Ted Cruz's birth in Calgary, Alberta disqualifies him from the presidency. Trump said that, oh, he's not personally concerned about that issue and won't sue, but Democrats will sue, and it's something that will be hanging over Ted Cruz's head. Cruz, meanwhile, says that he does not need legal advice from Donald Trump. Also, big exchanges between Cruz and Rubio, again fighting over who's the squishier one on immigration and on their tax plans. So, Amy, where does all of this leave us? Trump is going to win this thing, isn't he?
I'm not going to go that far to say that yet. But listen, what I saw last night was a much more disciplined, much improved Donald Trump. The candidate that we saw at the very beginning, who was sort of at the very beginning of this race, who was sort of flailing around and looked like he was swatting at flies and very uncomfortable and is not that candidate anymore. He was very confident.
I thought you were about Jeb Bush for a second there.
I don't think, you know what, Rich? Jeb never came to the stage looking particularly good, and he's leaving not looking particularly strong. And that is been the only consistent thing in this race so far. So listen, I think where if somebody was looking at this debate to see a Trump collapse, they weren't going to find it. If establishment folks wanted to use this as another example, Republican establishment folks, another example of why Trump is off the rails, they didn't find it. That said, I have this crazy theory that we should probably wait until people start voting before we start writing people off or on. It's just a theory.
That excuse is only going to work for a few more weeks.
Yeah. I know. I have two more weeks.
Rich, you tweeted something fascinating this week. Your tweet said, "From my conversations, GOP establishment move on Trump is moving from fear and loathing to resignation and rationalization. That is, that he'd run better than Cruz and slam Hillary." Is this... this is the acceptance stage of Trump grief. What's this change that you're seeing?
There's at least some of that, and it is in part because the establishment considers Cruz a pretty much a sure loser in a general election, and anything they would do to try to stop Trump would only help Cruz and vice versa. And I thought the debate was clearly there are two dominant figures. Ted Cruz stood up to Donald Trump. He owned him in the eligibility debate, lost the New York values debate, but Cruz has just been growing in stature during this process. And Trump has been getting better. That New York values answer, it's hard to imagine any politician from either party doing it better than Donald Trump did last night. His final answer, the concluding statement, he actually got quieter and softer, and it was very effective, showing much more range than we've seen. And again, it was evident on the debate how he's set the tone of this entire primary battle, because he stood there and said, "Yes, I'm angry." And you look at the kind of the most Obama-esque candidate in the field, Marco Rubio. He was sounding angry and harsh last night was a deliberate shift by his team. And then obviously Trump has set the terms of the debate. You had the Muslim travel ban vetted, brought up again. There wasn't the harsh denunciations that you got universally. Everyone's kind of sidestepped it, except for Jeb Bush, who was typically, unfortunately, completely ineffectual.
Bob, what did you make of that New York values exchange? Because, you know, it seems fairly standard in a Republican campaign to complain about Washington insiders or San Francisco liberals. And I thought it was remarkable how this thing actually seems to have turned into a little bit of a minefield for Ted Cruz, even though it's fundamentally similar.
Well, we don't know how it plays in the rest of the country because New York baiting is a disguised form of what has traditionally been a form of anti-Semitism. It's certainly an attempt to marginalize people who live in the most important city in many ways. And it has echoes, to my mind, of a kind of a dangerous populism on the right that you find in Europe. A stressing of provincial values and so forth, and blaming a whole population base. So, yeah, I thought there was a little bit ominous. On the other hand, I think Cruz is a formidable candidate. I think, you know, he certainly has the establishment credentials. He's certainly an excellent debater. He could have appeal to a Hispanic vote. He has said some things that make sense, particularly the thing that Rubio attacks him on the national security state, although he's rapidly moving back. But I really think the problem here in this election is that the economy is the big deal. The market is tanking as we go to air. People's savings, their 401k savings, are going in the toilet once again. We're certainly not out of this recession. And on the Republican side, with the collapse of Rand Paul, you don't really have anyone providing a critique of the Bush, Obama, Clinton economics, bail out Wall Street and screw Main Street. So it leaves Bernie Sanders as, for my money, the only interesting candidate. If it's a Hillary Clinton versus one of these Republican candidates, it'll be interesting on social issues that are important. But the fact is, on the economy, Obama did what George W. Bush did. And that's Clinton's policy. And it's true on the major economic issues, whether it's Medicare or anything else. And so Sanders now, I think, has emerged as the only interesting part of this whole election. And I'm thrilled that he's doing better.
Yeah. I think there is one candidate on the Republican side who's offering a critique of sort of centrist establishment economics or conservative establishment economics, and that's been Donald Trump. I mean, he's the one out there, you know, saying we need a 45% tariff on goods from China and then saying he never said that we needed a 45% tariff on goods from China and who made up that quote. But it's been an interesting mix, right? Because he, you know, came out raging against all these multimillionaires who pay almost no tax. And then he put out a tax plan that would give those multimillionaires a huge tax cut. His positioning hasn't been coherent, but I think it has tapped in rhetorically to a lot of those same concerns that Bernie Sanders and other populists have been going at about how the system's been working for the insiders and not for outsiders. And I'm not sure people do read the fine print. I'm not sure that, you know, the fact that his tax plan really would give a big tax cut to millionaires ends up mattering for that.
That China answer is very telling because it was literally all over the map. At times, he seemed to be opposed to a tariff and considered a smear by your newspaper. And then at times, within 15 seconds later, he seemed to be endorsing it. But it communicated strength, which is underlines the Trump phenomenon in a major way. But if Trump wins the nomination, it will have opened up a major populist space within the Republican Party that hasn't existed there in decades and decades and decades. And one of the interesting parts of this phenomenon, it used to be that the anti-establishment sentiment in the Republican Party was entirely ideologically purist and based on the idea that the leadership wasn't really pure on kind of check the box conservative ideological issues. And now you have Trump, who is completely impure and very, very interesting and kind of powerful, but also kind of incoherent and wrong on a lot of things, grabbing a lot of that anti-establishment sentiment.
Amy, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I'm going to pick up on the populist piece and then make one more point. And that is that the Republican Party does look very different from today than it did decades ago. This is now a party that is equally divided by people who have a college degree and those who don't. You know, we think in the olden days, 20, 30 years ago, Republicans were the white-collar party, Democrats were the blue-collar party, not so much anymore. And this populist sentiment is a big issue within the Republican Party in a way it hasn't been before. The economic anxiety, even stuff that Robert is talking about, feeling like the system's rigged. So this is where, you know, this divide, it's no longer ideological. It is much more economic. And the other thing about Donald Trump, let's remember, he's been making a lot of statements. He contradicts himself all the time. He says, to your point about the New York Times, I never said that. It's actually on audio. No one has run one single ad showing the many different positions of Donald Trump. And this is what I mean about let's wait till voters vote. I think there is certainly momentum for Donald Trump right now, going into Iowa, going into New Hampshire. At some point, and this is the gamble that Marco Rubio is making, at some point, the voters start to say, okay, now we winnowed the field out. There are 2, 3, maybe 4 choices. Let's get serious about our pick. Then the real sort of discussions about Donald Trump and a deeper dive and more focus on the many different sides of Donald Trump comes up. Maybe it'll be too late by then, but it still needs to happen.
Can I just jump in here for a second?
Yeah.
I mean, there's an assumption that every demagogue is a populist, and there's no distinction. What Trump is a demagogue. There's no coherence to his populism. This is an outrageous, exploitative billionaire who could go any which way on it, and he's just trying to appeal to the crowd. And to talk about him and Bernie Sanders in the same breath is insulting to intelligence, logic, fact, and everything else. Bernie Sanders has devoted his life to a rational evaluation of what happens in society, and I think he's been on the right side of these questions. So I don't think we should misuse this word. I do think Rand Paul, some of the principal libertarians on the Republican side, have an authentic conservative populist position. For instance, they're critical. Why is the Federal Reserve raising interest at a time when deflation is the big problem? Are they once again trying to help Wall Street instead of Main Street? There are real issues to be raised. Ted Cruz has gone back and forth on a number of these issues, as he has on foreign policy. But if Ted Cruz could be an extremely important candidate if he takes on some of those libertarian ideas of being against a rigged Wall Street system. And I would point out, by the way, we're leaving out Hillary here. I think Hillary is really vulnerable. Her chief financial advisor, who attacked Sanders viciously, is Gary Gensler, one of the architects of the whole deregulation, Robert Rubin Ackler, and he's the one daring to attack Sanders. And there's, real issue here that Hillary Clinton is carrying water for Wall Street, and on foreign policy, she's definitely a neoconservative hawk. And if Ted Cruz were to bring up those issues in some kind of interesting way, he'd give her a tremendous amount of trouble, I think, on
Bob,
the progressive side.
The problem with your theory here is that Rand Paul is nowhere in the polls.
I said that. That's why the Republicans—
The candidate who has tapped into the popular passions of the Republican base is Donald Trump. Like,
right.
Populism isn't just about, agreeing with it's not about a specific set of policy viewpoints. It's about promoting what is perceived as the interests of the ordinary people over the elites. And you can have left-wing and right-wing versions of that.
Of course.
But the thing that there is passion for on the right is not the Rand Paul
raising the tax on China and doing the things Trump is talking about and blasting undocumented people and all of this garbage has nothing to do with helping the average person. That's why he's a demagogue and not a populist. There is a consistent conservative position. Paul Ryan, for example, in the last week, has stated some genuine populist positions. He says the Republican Party has to deal with poverty. The Republican Party has to deal with race, has to deal with the incarceration rates among minorities. So Paul Ryan, actually, who's not running, does reflect a consistent conservative populist approach to the economy. That's not Donald Trump, who is a dangerous demagogue and a clown.
Let us know what you thought about this week's debate at kcrw.com/LRC, on our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's @LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Bernie Sanders poll rise. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at truthdig.com and host of the KCRW podcast Scheer Intelligence. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report is also with us. So on the Democratic side of the presidential race, there's been quite a bit of movement. A new CBS New York Times poll has Hillary up just 7 points on Bernie Sanders nationally. She was leading by 20 points in the previous poll. And there's a sense of increasing nervousness among establishment Democrats who are backing Hillary. Amy, what do you make of this? Has this been a real shift in the Democratic race? And is this a shift that could actually mean Hillary's path to the nomination is vulnerable?
Yeah, you know, I was just out in Iowa and New Hampshire over the course of the last 2 weeks. And what's striking about the Democratic primary is that it feels so similar to where we were in 2008. And when you break down the polls, it looks almost exactly similar as well, which is Hillary Clinton's base of support, her coalition, remains the same coalition she had in 2008. It's a little bit older. It's heavily female. It's more core Democratic. And Bernie Sanders, meanwhile, has much of the Obama coalition. It's younger, less Democratic, more independent. Where Hillary Clinton's is what she's banking on is she has something that she didn't. She ended up losing in 2008 to Barack Obama, and that's African-American support. But when it comes to states like Iowa and New Hampshire that are overwhelmingly white, that you can get a lot of young people engaged in the process, and where independents can vote and play a big role, she's in trouble. And I think what it means is, look, Bernie Sanders could certainly score an upset victory. Well, it wouldn't be an upset. He could certainly score a victory in either one of those states. The real question will be what happens after he gets out of states that look demographically and, as I said, politically, ideologically, like New Hampshire and Iowa. It becomes more problematic. But when, again, being out there in those two states, talking to people who are longtime watchers of politics out there, the one thing that they do say is they feel like Hillary Clinton has a better ground operation than she did in 2008, whereas Bernie Sanders is not to the level that Obama was in 2008 with his ground operation. And you also see while there's a tremendous amount of support and enthusiasm for Sanders, it doesn't have that sort of fervent energy that I remember being and seeing and feeling in Iowa, especially at the end of 2007 going into 2008. So, look, I think it's a very, very close race. But if it stays very close, you got to give, I think, Hillary, because of her ability to organize, the ability to win. But look, the fact that she's coming out so strongly against Bernie Sanders, that her campaign continues to push back and try to figure out what is the attack that works on him, and they haven't quite figured it out yet, shows that they are worried and they should be.
Bob, I think it's interesting. One of the attacks we have seen this week has been on single-payer health care, with Hillary basically hitting Sanders from the right and saying, you know, his plan's gonna be really expensive. He hasn't explained how he'll pay for it. And I think it's an odd fight for Hillary to be picking, but I think it's also an interesting fight over the soul of the Democratic Party about, will we tell people that they should pay more taxes in order to get a bigger, more active government?
It is a battle over basic principles of who do you care about? I mean, Hillary Clinton is the Goldman Sachs candidate. Let's not kid ourselves. She has Chelsea out there daring to attack Bernie Sanders for wanting to cut Medicare. Bernie Sanders, for God's sake. I mean, the one person in the country you can rely on not only to protect Medicare, but to expand it to every American. That's his health care plan. And so here's Chelsea, married to a Goldman Sachs banker, runs a foundation that gets all this money, if not from Wall Street, from Saudi Arabia and other places, and has the effrontery to attack him. And what is she defending? Hillary, who gave us a health care plan under Bill Clinton, then followed by Barack Obama, that put the insurance companies in charge of health care. And so you have a health care plan now where costs are rising, where the deductibles are so large many people can't use the program. And so this thing that should have been a win-win for Obama, you know, improving the health system is one of his negatives. So I just don't get the arrogance of the Clinton people. I think they're really vulnerable. And whether it's Cruz or Trump, I could see a very effective campaign against Hillary. And I think one of the interesting things the polls are showing is that Sanders is quite formidable against the Republican candidates. So this guy who was given no chance at the beginning, is now a very serious candidate. And I want to say one thing about the African-American vote, which people are assuming is monolithic and stupid or something. I mean, the fact is, black college graduates, according to the Federal Reserve study, saw a 70% decline in their wealth. They were the hardest hit group. People who graduate from college. Blacks and browns in this country were much harder hit than anybody else by the housing meltdown, by the economic policies of deregulation that the Clintons are associated with. A Republican candidate might point that out if they had some sense about him. The fact of the matter is Hillary Clinton is highly vulnerable precisely to people who are hurting, and black people are hurting.
Rich, I feel like we're in this funny situation where the two parties are looking at each other, wondering whether they're going to nominate an especially weak general election candidate. And I think Democrats are saying to themselves, well, we can nominate Bernie Sanders because maybe Bernie could beat Ted Cruz. And I think Republicans still generally think Hillary will probably win, but I think they look at this possibility that Sanders will win and say, well, maybe we can elect somebody more conservative than we thought we could. How does that dynamic work? And if we end up with a Cruz-Sanders race or something, are we going to end up with a serious third-party candidacy in the middle? Because that feels like an extremely polarized election.
Yeah, I would say on the Hillary general election matchups, it's really awkward for her because she wants to make an electability argument against Bernie Sanders. But if you believe the general election matchups at this point, which I'm not sure you should put too much stock in them, he runs much stronger. And I think that's just a sign a generic Democrat does better than Hillary Clinton. And the one read I have on the Clinton-Sanders dynamic, it's a little bit like the Republican established had actually managed to prop up Jeb Bush as the only candidate and scare everyone out and really skew the entire process his way. So there's only really a kind of outlier candidate who's willing to challenge him, say Ben Carson. And at this point, if that were the case, Jeb has been, you know, such a weak performer, like Hillary. He's been around for so long, like Hillary. He generates no excitement, like Hillary. Ben Carson would be at 45% and a real threat against him.
I think the key difference, though, is that Hillary's favorable numbers with Democrats are so much better than Jeb's are with Republicans.
Yeah.
Now, maybe her numbers would be worse if Democrats felt like they had six other similar choices who they preferred in various ways. But clearly, even though the poll numbers have been moving away from her in the horse race, it doesn't seem like there's huge discontent in the Democratic Party with Hillary Clinton and this idea that she is somehow a sellout. So I don't
right.
think it's
she's, not
she's better than Jeb.
Right. She's not as unpopular within her own party as Jeb is, which does go to Bernie generating genuine enthusiasm. And it has to do with this passionate sincerity that he has and that he oozes and makes someone like me, who's completely on the opposite side of the spectrum ideologically, respect him in a way I can't Hillary Clinton.
I was just going to agree that, look, Hillary Clinton is better liked. In fact, I've not been to a Bernie Sanders rally where a voter doesn't say to me, you know what, I like Hillary. I just would rather have Bernie Sanders. But they're also they would be quite happy with her as the nominee. That's very different than what's going on the Republican side, where the number of people who have said, I absolutely would walk out of the party if Donald Trump were the nominee, if Jeb Bush were the nominee, if Ted Cruz were the nominee. Very, very, very different dynamic, which is why it's going to be even more fascinating to see how the Republican Party kisses and makes up, if it does, at the Cleveland Convention.
I would like to just challenge that as the left person here. I was just on the Nation magazine cruise, in which we had a good subgroup, a focus group of about 300 people. And then the Nation magazine did endorse Bernie Sanders. And there were people who write for the Nation and edit it and so forth, some of them who favored Hillary. there's a lot of resentment on the left side of the Democratic Party, and that's a pretty big side for sellout politics. First of all, there are people in the Latino community who refer to Barack Obama as the deporter in chief. There's been a lot of contempt shown for the very voting bloc that swung to Democrats that has in some ways been betrayed, major ways. There's a real lot of concern on the progressive side of the Democratic Party about the neoconservative hawk-like posture of a Hillary Clinton who got us into this mess in Libya and Syria and everywhere else and who voted for the Iraq War. There's a lot of concern about the Wall Street connection with these people. And I do think maybe it won't be maybe a Jill Stein of the Green Party, but there is a possibility of splitting off. Why are you laughing? Does she not have a serious program? It's just the mass media doesn't cover her. But I'll tell you something. You may have a good handle on the Republican and the centrist, but I'm telling you something. If it's Hillary versus, you know, Cruz, or certainly against Jeb Bush, if it were Hillary against Jeb Bush, you'd have a strong sentiment on the progressive side of the Democratic Party to go for the Green Party or some alternative. And you can laugh at it on this show, but as somebody who has some contact with a leftist position, let me tell you, it's something the Hillary people should worry about.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, what's your rant?
Jeb Bush ran an ad about how Donald Trump is a jerk for mocking a disabled reporter. Now, unfortunately, this is typical of the Bush campaign 2 months late after this actual event happened, but it was extremely well done, and anyone who's the brother or sister or mother or father of a disabled person has to be moved by and appreciate that ad.
Amy Walter, what's on your mind?
Wow, that was much more high-minded than mine. I was going for the real rant, Rich, which is the amount of time now that I'm on planes. What's become of this thing of people that sit behind you that decide they're going to jump into the aisle and get ahead of you and then take their bag out in front of you? I don't understand. Didn't we all agree that if I'm in row 10, I go, you're in row 12, you go after me? When did that change? What's happening
to
America?
That's a wonderfully crotchety rant, Amy. Congratulations.
It's been a while since I've heard somebody come up with a new category of plane behavior to complain about. That's really innovative, Amy.
Thank you.
Bob Scheer, it's your soapbox.
Yeah, as opposed to Christy, I have long supported Planned Parenthood, and I think they've been a great organization, but I'm very upset that they jumped into the primary to support Hillary Clinton, who really did not help poor families. And the Clinton, her husband and Hillary herself, favored a welfare reform beginning in Arkansas that was an absolute disaster. And two-thirds of the people on welfare were children. And we don't have a federal anti-poverty program of any substance anymore, thanks to the Clintons. And I don't think Planned Parenthood should consider that sound family planning when it hurts so many poor and vulnerable people.
Well, so the debate this week included a fight over one of my favorite topics, which is value-added taxes. Such a tax, it's kind of like a sales tax. It's at the core of Ted Cruz's tax plan. It would raise $25 trillion over a decade, which is substantially more than the payroll tax and the corporate tax combined. Those are taxes that Cruz would repeal to create this tax. Marco Rubio pointed out that he wanted this tax and that seniors would pay a lot of it. It would make everything more expensive. And Cruz just responded that, no, it's not a value-added tax. It's a business flat tax. But he can call it whatever he wants. You read the tax plan, it is a value-added tax similar to the ones that finance governments in places like Germany and France. And I think that's going to become an increasing issue for Ted Cruz because conservatives have a lot of good reasons for thinking that tax is a way to raise a lot of money secretly and ultimately take money out of people's pockets. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Robert Scheer, Rich Lowry, and Amy Walter. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Hannah Tayson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
So if you like pajamas, I'll wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of all. Let's call the
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.